Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning. This is What's Next. I am your host for this morning, Charles Gilbert, executive producer of the show. And today we have two returning guests, Deja Middlebrook from Walking Through Solutions here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we have Chaney Brockington as well.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yes. The month of June is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. May was Mental Health Awareness Month. And I wanted to get you two here to discuss this was an idea that Chaney, you had reached out to us about, which is discussing the state of Black mental wellness in Buffalo and the importance of discussing the effects of intergenerational trauma. For those who have one of the last episodes I've done with Andre Stokes, who we did want to be here, but unfortunately he could not make it. We discussed very in detail about Black men and the stigma behind not being able to seek therapy. Like, why is it that Black men are so afraid of it? I'll throw that question to both of you. So why do you think that is such a big topic? Because I mean, more than 50% of Black men have been exposed to trauma to some degree.
I will say building the confidence to be vulnerable is challenging. And if you think about men, especially Black men, they want to be solution focused. They're like, I can solve it. If it's a problem presented to them, they're looking for a solution. How can I fix it? And when you think about therapy, it's like, I'm kind of outsourcing that solution. And that can feel like maybe I'm inadequate. Then you also have the stigma of mental health just generally in our society, where it's like, oh, therapy is for people that have serious mental health issues. And it's like, I'm not them. They try to distinguish themselves from that population. But therapy can be social skills, like you said, exploring the trauma and even just acknowledging that you have trauma, because trauma is subjective. If you don't identify a bad experience in your life as traumatic, it may still affect you. But if you haven't accepted that, you're not going to go try to resolve it or fix it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with that. First of all, I just want to say, Black men, I love you.
Yes.
I think that's so important.
Yes.
Because we don't talk enough about Black men's mental health in general, but we just don't talk enough about Black mental health. I actually, coming off of your question, and I think I spoke about this when I was talking with Jay about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I always bring it back to this because I think it's so important. I actually think that we are in a space where Black men are starting to recognize that their health is not just important, but it needs to be prioritized. And mental health is a part of that. But I also think that when we talk about mental health, if we think about it from like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's this chart, it's this triangle, a lot of people have seen it, which basically shows the hierarchy of how it is that we get our needs met.
Yes.
So we start with our basic needs, right? So physiological needs, housing, shelter, safety, water, all of that stuff. Then we talk about safety. Do you have a safe home? Do you have a safe place to stay? What does your community look like? And then you start to slowly move up the stage of self-actualization and self-esteem and what is your truth and what are your values and what do you want to do with your life and what's your perspective? And not to get all psychological, but essentially the whole point of that is if your basic needs aren't met, if you don't have your food, water, shelter, clothing, housing met, if you don't feel safe in your community, if you don't feel as if you are able to be emotionally unguarded in some ways, really let your guard down, not just in your home, but with the people that you're around. I know we were kind of talking about this a little bit before we got on today, then you're not going to be in a space. Your mind literally cannot conceptualize and fully go into that space of what are some of my stressors? What are some of my traumas? How do I process this? How do I learn to mitigate some of the anger that I'm feeling or the trauma that I've experienced? Like, it literally can't even go to that space. And so I think when we talk about Black men in our community, especially, who are some of the most vulnerable and some of the most affected population, especially in this country, we have a history, and we're going to talk about intergenerational trauma, where our communities have literally not had their basic needs met for so long. Mm-hmm. Like, we are still dealing with food insecurity. We are still dealing with food desert. We are still dealing with poverty in Buffalo. And so until those needs get met, it's very difficult to then say, well, we're going to focus on mental health. We're going to focus on your wellness. We're going to go to therapy. If we don't have access to our basic needs and we don't feel safe, it's very difficult to then normalize this idea of we're just going to start moving towards taking care of our wellness.
What do you think? You're a Black man.
Yeah. We're just throwing out a bunch of stuff. Yeah.
I agree. You know, I agree with the premise of it. It is. It's where you look at the role of man, and we are supposed to be the providers. And if we cannot provide for our family for whatever reason, that is stress on us, mm-hmm. you know. And then we have like the back and forth, you know, if you can't provide, if you're in a relationship, your partner is going to stress you out because they're in the mindset of, well, you're supposed to be the man. You're supposed to be providing. Why are you not providing? So then now they have to, as men, well, if I can't get a job, I have to resort to doing this, mm-hmm. you know, going to the street life, you know, acting out of character, whatever the case may be. And that amount of pressure just keeps building up. And then we as men don't have an outlet.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way to express ourselves. Some people don't, you know, we go to vices, drugs, sex, alcohol,
yep.
abuse. You know, we do this because we don't have a safe space to be vulnerable, mm-hmm. express, like, I'm going through a lot. Where can I go to express this? Yeah, there's the typical stereotypical, oh, everybody goes to the barbershop,
mm-hmm.
you know, but the barbershop can only get you so far because even they may be going through something too.
Right. Or they don't have the tools.
Yeah.
Or how to respond. Because you think, even with male friendships, it's interesting because you could be friends, and I've noticed this with especially like younger men, you can be friends with someone for 10, 15 years. Yeah. And if you ask them like, oh, a specific detail, like, oh, like what's their favorite food? That's your best friend. I don't know. Or, oh, such and such, you know, their sibling just died. You know, did you reach out? Well, I told them sorry for your loss. It's like, well, where is that space? You know, like, or did you ask a follow-up question? You know, his girlfriend just broke up with him. Did you ask him a follow-up on that? What happened? Like, some of those things.
It's crazy that you say that because as you're saying that, I'm thinking about my friendships. I'm thinking of my relationships with my best friends. And my one friend, I remember distinctly, we were sitting there one day and he was going through a lot. And I can sense it. I'm a person, I'm big on energy. I can pick up on energy real quick. And we sat there and we just really had a moment where it was like, let's talk. Let's sit there and conversate. Then I have another friend where it's like, we try to have the conversation and it's like, nah, I'm okay. You're really not.
Mm-hmm.
But you have this like shield around us as men. We have the shield where we don't want to show it. as I said before we got on air, I don't like in the movie Get Rich or Die Trying, where he says, show no love, love will get you killed.
Mm-hmm.
That phrase bothers me to this day, because it's like, that's the continuing, the continuation of that toxic masculinity that mm-hmm. just breeds within us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no. And it's really, it's present in our culture, right? There is this like, I'm heartless, I'm cold, right? Like, if I'm cold, no one can hurt me, mm-hmm. right? It's this protection, but it's also hurting us, right? Because it's not allowing us to get real with each other. It's not allowing us to be there. And I think to your point about the barbershop, right? Even like the barbershop, beauty shop, like going and get your haircut. A lot of times it's also, what type of advice are you getting in there? Because we are a very collective mm-hmm. people. Black men are a very collective people. We operate in our community. We show up in our community. Like, we are usually in our community, like, in numbers. Like, we come out in droves.
Yes.
So when we're there and we have that collective community, a lot of times we are literally just, like, filtering through words that we've heard from somebody else, right? Our grandfather when he went to the barbershop, or our uncle, or our, you know, big unk, or our cousin, or whoever it might be. And if they also haven't dealt with their trauma, they're just trying to give us the knowledge that they have. They're giving us the lessons that they've learned. Mm-hmm. But their lessons are also passed down from trauma and stress and all of those different things. Because like we just talked about, it's generational. Like, there's so much that's just been dealt with from every single generation. And so, yeah, it really impacts.
I also want to dive into one of the biggest reasons why I know for me, I was hesitant to seek therapy. Like, I'm big on it. I still go to therapy. But the reason why I was so hesitant on it was because I didn't see anyone that looked like me in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that I have two black women who are in that field doing this, you know, because it is very much needed. Now, I say that and then it's gonna sound weird. My therapist is actually not black. But what my therapist does is when there's certain things that I talk to them about, they'll sit there and say, okay, I'm gonna recommend this person to you. I can't help you in this space because you need someone that is of your background. And they have, and that's why I still go to her, mm-hmm. because she noticed, okay, there's a lot of stuff that you have going on, but there's certain elements that I cannot help you with.
Yeah.
But here's this resource. Here's this particular person.
Yeah. It's a lot of self-awareness.
Yes.
I've been to non-black therapists and mm-hmm. had great experiences. One in particular, which was really great. But it's that self-awareness to say, if they seem like, okay, this is a racial trauma, let me refer you to someone else, because you expressing your racial trauma to me, who may be of the race that may have traumatized you, that can be triggering. Mm-hmm. So like when you think about the Tops massacre that happened in Buffalo, when it first happened, it was conversations about like, we need to have a culturally responsive approach here, because yes, anyone can help you, but in this moment, because of this specific issue that you're facing, I might not be the best person,
right.
And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also just like that piece of having someone that looks like you as well. Right. Like feeling safe. Like, again, we are like, we're community people.
Mm-hmm.
We really appreciate our community and we thrive. Oftentimes we'll talk about like how it can hurt, but we really do thrive in our community. And so knowing that someone else is going to, there's an automatic like assumption, I think, even with my clients, and I'm sure you've had this experience too, like as a black therapist, where there's just an automatic assumption that you get me. Right? Like you see me, you understand me in some way, because just because we share the same skin color.
Right.
And in some ways, it's not always like the exact same lived experiences, but in a lot of ways, just by being in this body, it is. And so I think that that is a big part of like, yeah, people want to see others that look like them, but we still have disparities as it relates to seeing black male therapists. Like, I know a lot of
male therapists.
Yeah, just male therapists in general. You're right. Yeah, honestly. It's really tough, right? And so, like, I do have clients where they're saying, like, I want to see another black man. Mm-hmm. And the pool is so small. And it matters so much. But we still have a lot of disparities.
I want to say, Chaney and I went to the University at Buffalo together. The mm-hmm. School of Social Work. And when you think about therapists of color,
even our classroom,
it wasn't that many of us. You could count on one hand. Then you look at the amount of men in the room, it's way less than the minorities in the room. And then when you look at black men in the room, I could think of, besides Andre, I could think of two.
Yeah. And how much of that is, again, all the things that we'll talk about as it relates to, like, intergenerational trauma and all of those things, but also even when we have access to education, so that's one thing. But then when we are going for, like, those graduate degrees that allow you to do, like, licensed professional clinical work, whatever the case may be, how many, because of the stress of, I have to be a provider, I have to show up for my community, I have to make a lot of money, are going into professions where maybe they do have an interest in social work, or do have an interest in clinical psychology, or do have an interest in counseling, but because there is, you know, stigma surrounding social workers or just clinicians not being as lucrative in the field as other professions, like a licensed electrician or a contractor or a lawyer or whatever the case may be, go into another field because it's going to make more money and I got to provide. Like, a lot of those stressors, I feel like, are intercorrelated.
Or if you think at, like, even a basic level, the soft skills, a lot of the work I do is social skills building, mm-hmm. because some of those soft skills that you would need to be a therapist, if you look at it, it's mirrored in, like, coaching. People coach teams, sports teams, things like that. But when you think about therapy, men don't always have the same language that higher education is looking for sometimes. So when you're in these programs, you may feel like, I don't fit, or this isn't for me, because you, one, don't see anyone that looks like you.
Right.
And then two, it's like, when you think of soft skills, like, some of the ways that we communicate as therapists, it's just not organic sometimes for men. So you're learning it, and we're learning it too, but it can seem like, why would I say that? Like, you're like, I've never seen anyone talk in this way. Why does it have value? And I think just having other black therapists, even if it's not your therapist, but knowing, like, oh, I know a guy who does therapy,
right,
that's
right,
either went to therapy or does it for their profession, it kind of normalizes, like, he's cool, you know, he's all right. Yeah. And he went, so I'll try it.
He's all good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think even the way we manipulate those soft skills, I don't want to say manipulate, but the way that we kind of play around, I know I definitely check the soft skills a little bit, for sure. Like, I use them, of course, because I got to get my degree. But in some ways, like, the way in which we can kind of come across, I think that's, like, such a gift as, like, black therapists. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, of course, there's going to be active listening. Of course, like, we're going to do some skills. We're going to do it. But the way in which I'm going to approach my black men and women is going to look very, very different, and I'm going to meet them where they're at, right? So, yeah, we're going to use those soft skills, but at the same time, it's maybe not going to be like, you know, what does that feel like for you, right? Like, now, where do you feel it in your body? Or, like, what's going on? Like, what's really happening today? And really just, like, getting down, like, deep and being honest and, like, being transparent so that we can let our guards down and see, like, nah, this is a cool space.
Yeah, because, like, and when you talk about letting the guard down, it brings up the whole trust, you know, mm-hmm. and that's something that, you know, amongst black people in a whole, when it comes to our health, we've been misguided, and trust has been broken. You know, we could date back to even, you know, let's think about the Tuskegee experiment.
Yeah.
That, along with all the other things, is why when people do, like, now when you go to set up a doctor's appointment or you're enrolling into that, they ask those questions like, do you prefer someone of, like, color? Do you prefer a male or female? Because mm-hmm. they're starting, the medical field is starting to realize now, like, they're going to want, more than likely, they're going to want someone that looks like them to help them, because then they'll know their needs are going to be met,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And that trust. Have you ever lied to your therapist? Because I've seen it.
Yeah.
Or even, like, in the beginning, I would say for me, when I first went to therapy, because the trust is not there. So then you might sugar, you know, water coat, like, you know, water down, like, what you're experiencing until that trust is formed. Or some stuff you don't want to bring up because you're like, I don't know you like that. Why would I?
Well, see, my first experience with therapy was very, like, I said I'll never do it again because the way he spoke to me. You know, it goes, and this is why that misguidance, that mistrust, because he didn't look at me as an adult. He talked to me as if I was a kid.
Like, he's the expert. In what way? When you're the expert of your life.
I'm expressing, like, I just had my child. I just had my daughter. Mm-hmm. Some stuff happened. I blacked out. Because of that, they were like, okay, we want to, he needs to seek therapy. So, okay, cool. I end up finding this therapist, and I remember sitting in his office, and I'm expressing to him, like, I'm a new father. I'm going through this. I don't know. And he's like, just the way he talked down, you know, as a white man, he's talking down to me. And I'm sitting there looking like, nah, I left out of there. And I was like, I don't never want to go to therapy again. But it was watching my daughter go through therapy that made me go, okay, if this girl who at the time, maybe she was 12, is sitting across from this woman and is telling her, like, this is what I'm feeling. This is why I've been feeling this way. She's 12. What am I doing? She helped me go, okay, I can be this vulnerable.
Wow. Yeah.
Because if I'm going to be the example, I need to do this. I need to show her that it's okay to express yourself, to talk about these things.
Yeah.
And maybe the first or second session I had, I started to let that guard down because I'm very guarded. Like, I just had the conversation with my supervisor. She was like, when I first met you, I couldn't read you. And I'm good on reading people, but I couldn't read you. I was like, well, there's a reason why. Because I have this guard up. I don't want to let you in because I've been burnt in the past. You know, it's that, we'll say it's that vulnerability that I have where it's like, I don't want to bring too many people around me. But then once I get a sense for you, I'm like, okay, well, then I can let my guard down. And then you get to see, like, okay, well, no, he's not a a-hole, you know, because that's just, I'm just bringing that approach to it where it's like, I don't want people really to come in. And then with that, with my therapist, that's where that trust came into play.
Yeah.
She was able to sit there and help me get through all this and then realize, and we'll get into it when we come back from break, the essence of, like, trauma, PTSD, all of that.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break. This is Charles Gilbert, and I'm here with Deja Middlebrook from Walk Through Solutions and Channing Brockington. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Welcome back. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I am your host for this morning, Charles Gilbert, here with two amazing guests. I have Deja Middlebrook from Walking Through Solutions and Channing Brockington. We are discussing men's mental health. This basically feels like a therapy session.
This on house, no.
We'll bill you later. No, I'm just kidding.
So before break, we were talking about the intergenerational trauma and the post-traumatic PTSD. And as I was telling both of you before we started recording, when I was introduced to PTSD, I was introduced to it from the realm or the lens of it only being military base. You know, I only heard it with people in the military. And it wasn't until I had my session, one of my sessions, and I'm going over, like, stuff that I went through. And she, my therapist, was like, you have PTSD. And I was like, what? And she's like, it's whenever you have trauma, that's what it is. you have suffered from it, no matter what. Me witnessing the arguments between my parents, that was trauma for me.
Yeah.
You know, me seeing my dad walk out the house, trauma. I still, to this very day, can replay that whole day in my head. That's trauma for me. So from you two, and I see that you have this fascinating book that...
I know, I can't put it down. It's problematic.
What is your thoughts on that, especially for Black men? Because, you know, Black men, we do, as I said before, we have been exposed to trauma. What do you say towards that sense of having men being exposed to any form of trauma?
Oh, that's such a loaded question. I mean, there's so many places I could start, and I'm going to look to you so that I don't just ramble on about it, because this is such, and we were literally just talking about this downstairs too. Like, and I think even before we started rolling today, you were just acknowledging, like, we just have so much on our plate, right? We just have so much on our plate. And I think one of the things that, I'll just start by saying this, one of the things that I do in a lot of my sessions, especially when I'm working with our people, is I'll, you know, of course, ask like the nice questions of just, you know, how are you doing? How's your day? When we're first sitting in, and someone will come in, they'll be like, yeah, I'm good. I'm okay. Whatever the case may be. And then 3 minutes later, I'll ask again, how are you really doing today? Right? It's that second question. And that's when sometimes we'll get the tears flowing, or we'll start to really sit with, actually, no, today sucked. Right? Because we hold so much on a continuous basis, and oftentimes there's no safe space to, because we're working or we're going through the day or we're driving, we have to pick up our kids, whatever the case may be. There's no real space to actually sit with, no, today was really hard, or I woke up and I felt depressed, right? I don't even know what depression is, but I woke up and I knew something was off, right? And we're going to talk about that, like stress, anxiety, depression, like it shows up differently for us. And sometimes it doesn't always look the way that we've heard it talked about or seen it kind of whitewashed. But I think we, going back to my original point, we hold so much pressure and stress and trauma. We also hold the trauma from our past generations and from our ancestors. We are not that far removed from the horrors of slavery. We are not far removed at all from the horrors of Jim Crow, you know, segregation, all of the horrible experiences of the transatlantic slave trade and the African diaspora and all of those things. Many of us that are going to be listening to this podcast are going to be able to go back as soon as I say, think back to your grandma or your great aunt or your great, great, great grandmother. And you're going to think back to someone who, especially if she is of African descent or of living in this country, has experienced a significant amount of historical trauma. Right. I can trace it back. My grandparents, like I said, are from 1930s Mississippi and saw and literally fled and went to war and enlisted in the army to avoid Jim Crow in the South because they thought that was better or was going to provide them some type of safety than what the South was going to provide them with. And just the idea of that, the idea that war in some ways you think would provide you some sense of safety or protection more than your home country and your home area is a trauma in itself.
It's crazy.
When you think about it, right, it's wild. But I say all that to say that we are literally living a generation away from a significant amount of historical traumas, and then we are living in the present day. We just had a significant tragedy in Buffalo because of a food desert that we still have not addressed, and we're still not talking about, and we're still not putting all the necessary resources and have our necessary capitalist society putting the necessary resources into place to ensure that this food desert and the food insecurity that really was a precipitating factor in this tragic event happening, to really ensure that that does not happen again. And so there's a significant amount of trauma that takes place when you are living in a community, in an environment that continues to have these stressors and these historical traumas passed down. then you add on top of that the traumas that now, as a result of that, we're still experiencing in our community. Police brutality, right, for Black men is at the highest rate for our Black men. You have food insecurity, you have poverty, you have racism, you have the stressors of dealing with day-to-day work, you have childcare. You add all that on top of that, most of us are experiencing some form of trauma. I think Black people, we deserve and we need therapy so much because we are all in some ways experiencing some form of stressor that more than likely meets criteria for PTSD.
Yeah, and we're healing. So we're healing ourselves. We're healing the voice inside us from when we were children. So you brought up, which is a good point, you brought up the fact that the things that you experienced as a mm-hmm. child, when you went to therapy, you dove into those things. So if you think about, like, there's a adverse childhood experiences questionnaire, and I do this, especially I do it with our couples, but I do it in other settings too, because sometimes you could be with someone for years and you don't even know what happened to them as a child. And that inner voice of, like, you know, Charles when he was 5 years old, the sometimes that voice comes out.
That inner child.
Mm-hmm. And you're like, why are they acting this way? It's like, if you haven't healed that voice, or you haven't even realized that that's how you're operating from that five-year-old version of you, if you never heal that voice, you're going to still have that same cycle, that same problem is going to come up, and you're going to still be responding as if you're, you know, in that sense of fear mm-hmm. or like that lack of control, all of those things. So I think that when you think about trauma and all the things that Chaney just brought up, that compounded with the things that sometimes we seen as normal in our households, which as you get older, you see other people, other cultures, you're like, oh, that isn't normal. But if you think, if you, you know, like, oh, my parents argued all the time, and you think it's normal, so then when you become a parent or you're dating, you start to model those behaviors that you right. thought was, that's the role. Oh, a man is supposed to do this. And maybe that's right or wrong, or maybe you try to do opposite of them. But sometimes they don't have that role model or that, like, that guide of, like, what does providing look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. Something that I've been saying a lot to clients when we've been talking about, because you mentioned like childhood and you just talked about like your inner child as well.
Yeah.
The first people that we date are our parents.
Yeah.
You look at like the type that you liked. Like my first boyfriend, I look back and I look at like older pictures of like my dad at like my as my teenagers, and mm-hmm. I'm like, ew, he does kind of look like him.
Yeah. No, right? Like in like, some ways.
That is
a little cringe.
That is true. You know, but when you think about it, you know, they say that, you know, you do marry a representation of like your Absolutely. Mother or your father. Like, because as they say, for sons, for boys, men, your mother is your first love.
Mm-hmm.
For women, your father shows you or is supposed to show you what love is from yeah. a man's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Supposed to show you like, okay, as men, this is what I'm supposed to do
mm-hmm.
as being the provider, which then goes into the whole, well, my father showed me this. If you're not doing this, you're not really being a man.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that. He may have not been raised by a man.
Right.
You know, his father might have left. Like my father left at a very pivotal time. I'm entering, you know, this state of, okay, I'm about to be a teenager. I'm about to enter this whole new world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that figure.
Yeah.
That day-to-day figure mm-hmm. to help me navigate through life.
Yeah.
So now I have to learn from...
You supplement.
Yeah. I'm learning from other things. I'm learning from watching other people.
Yes.
You know, but I had a strong village around me that I didn't learn from the negative.
Yeah.
I may have seen something and said, nah, I'm not going to do that. But I wasn't surrounded by those elements that would cause me to steer into the wrong direction.
Mm.
You know?
And that's individual. Like, it's very resilient.
Yes.
It comes down to some people can be in an environment like that and they can work harder and they're resilient and they want to be somebody different.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could go the completely opposite. And you're like, well, no one taught me how to be better, so I'm not going to be better.
Yeah. And that's kind of like how it was. Like, I've mirrored myself being a parent based on what I didn't see.
Yeah.
So with my father, I didn't get that love. So I pour that into my daughter to the point where she gets sick of me. But she knows I'm there.
Yeah.
You know, she always will know that she can call me, text me, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll be there for her because I didn't have that with my father.
Can I ask a question? Who was the person that switched that for you? Because you said you had a village, right? And dad left at like a really crucial time. Who switched that value system? Because that's something that like this book that I'm like referencing, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, it talks a lot about that, of like one of the characteristics of like post-traumatic slave syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder, is like this vacant self-esteem where we are, it's not a matter of self-efficacy, it's a matter of like the worth and value that we see in ourselves. And something switched for you of, I did not receive this, and so I'm going to make sure that I also build that worth and value as a father and give that back to that next generation. So who is the person that then switched that for you? Because that's huge.
It has to be my daughter. It would have to be. I found out I was going to be a father. It was like, I was young.
Okay.
And I was like, all right, well, I have to man up. But once I seen her, I was just like, everything kind of switched.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have to do this. Everything that I didn't see, his failures, I'm going to learn from his failures and apply it to where I'm not going to do what he did. And I also think that, you know, it was also like she was, and then my therapist, you know, helped me realize that, okay, you have to, it's that switch. Whereas let's turn this knob. Because I always used to battle with that. I always used to battle with the thought of, I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not in a space where I can achieve anything. And it wasn't until I went through therapy and she was just like, well, no, look at everything that you've accomplished. Look at everything that you've done. You have a purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and there's still like weight on me. Like, don't. It is.
It's a lifelong journey.
Yes, it is. It's a lifelong journey. But it's also just the fact that, like, I look at even where I'm positioned now, like there's pressure. But I try not to let it overcome me to a degree, because it's like, you know, being where I'm at right now, I didn't think I would be talking about this right now, but being where I'm at right now, the pressure that I get all the time when I'm sitting behind that window and I talk to certain individuals and they're black men and they look at me and say, keep up the good work. It's that pressure right there where it's like, because they know there's not a lot of people that sit in your space.
Yeah.
So as a black man, I have that amount of pressure on my shoulders, along with the day-to-day operations that I have to deal with. I'm a father. I'm a son. You know, I told you guys what I've been going through this whole year. I have to take care of the house. And if it wasn't for me having the courage and bravery to say, you know what, I do need this help. Because for a while, I wasn't seeing my therapist. And then it was until what happened with my mother that made me say, okay, I need to go back.
Yeah.
Because I'm about to enter a space where I've never dealt with this before.
Yeah.
And she helped me kind of navigate and figure it out, because I'm the person that if there's a problem, provider,
yeah,
I want to try to solve it.
Yeah.
And she had to tell me, this, what you're going through, you physically cannot solve it.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have the control.
But as long as you're present, and that's what I had to realize. I had to sit back and realize that, okay, I have to be present for this. My presence is enough to help this situation. And that's where, like, I realized. And I hope that, you know, men, black men can realize that sometimes we don't have to be we don't have to physically do anything. Mm-hmm. We could just be present, and that's enough.
Yeah, I agree. I think some of the work that I do with couples is like when it comes to conflict resolution, sometimes men and women are having different conversations. A man is having a logical conversation of like, okay, this is the problem, what's the solution? Sometimes women are coming like, I have these feelings. I probably have the answer on how I want to proceed, but I'm still have to process through all the mud of the feelings that I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And so I try to do it together and show people like you have to have both. Yeah. When conflict or if it's a situation, it's you two versus the problem. So when you think about like a health scare, that's not within our control. However, I can be here for you and I can provide. I'm not providing the answer, but I'm providing emotional safety.
Yeah.
I'm providing a listening ear. I'm providing with, if you hungry, I could get that. You know, like all those other things. So I could take some stuff off your plate, even though I can't fix that. And it's not your job to.
Yeah.
What does the role of religion, church, play into the stigma with Black men in therapy? Because as we know, the church is like the safe haven, the safe space for the Black community. How does that play a role into all of this? Because we were talking about that as you and Chaney was alluding to your background off air.
This is I think it's a loaded question when you talk about religion and mental health. Right. I am still looking for whoever, and please somebody drop in the comments if people comment on this show or whatever happened. Please somebody comment, because I've been looking for that sweatshirt. I'm not sure if y'all have seen it, that says like Jesus in therapy.
No,
I've seen it. I haven't seen it in person. I've seen it online.
OK, yeah, OK. I've seen it online, and there's somebody that actually goes to my church that has it. So maybe I just need to hunt her down and find her and get the shirt. But the whole point of that is, I think we have to start having more conversations of more intersectionality surrounding it. Mm-hmm. Because I think what we talk about, and I want to hear your perspective as well as a Black man, I'm curious because my experience has been that oftentimes the church is another place that has stigmatized mental health and therapy because of the type of language that we utilize, right? So when someone is really struggling or someone is coming, like growing up, my childhood experiences and a lot of the experiences that my clients, many Black men, are coming to me and talking to me about are one of two things. Either the church doesn't feel like a safe space for me because it is this immediate overflow, especially in Black church, right, of a lot of emotion, right? But a lot of like, expected to be like very, very vulnerable and open up to people in the community that I don't know or I don't trust, right? Because just because we have community doesn't mean that we fully trust our community, right? There's always like this saying of like, who's all going to be there? Well, the church, you can't really ask that because you don't know who's going to be there.
Yeah.
It could be anybody that comes in. Or there is this sense of, I went to my church, I shared with them, or I, you know, involved myself in my religious community, and the response I got was just pray about it. And that in itself is a harm as well, right? Because then people are really struggling and are attributing their struggles to, I'm not doing something enough in my religious community. And spirituality isn't just about, you know, or religion in general. It's not just about like what you do, like where you go to practice your faith, going to the church or going to the mosque or whatever faith you practice. It's also about something that you just said, which is also like sitting and being present and learning as well. And I think a lot of times that gets twisted. The other thing that we have to talk about is spiritual abuse and religious trauma. And a lot of times there's church hurt that people have experienced.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because hurting people hurt people. And there are a lot of hurt people in our church communities.
Yeah.
So there's a really beautiful thing of being able to tie that religion to a space of healing. But there's also a lot of church hurt, church abuse, church trauma, and some language that we're using in our churches that is not helpful for our mental health, especially for Black men, I think.
I agree with the sentiment of like, you know, it sometimes I'm very honest. Sometimes I don't want to hear, just give it to God, you know, because it's like I'm going through this, but I need someone to explain to me.
Yes.
The how.
Mm-hmm. How? Why is this happening? All of this. And they, you know, just pray about it. Give it to God. There's a Bible verse for you.
Yeah. Cast your care.
And it's just like, I'm coming to you for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are supposed to help guide me in this. You know, most people go to the church because they're like, okay, you are of a guidance. But I don't need you to throw a Bible verse at me. I don't need you to go give it to God, pray about it. I need you to explain because I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
But when you tell me to do that, it's like, well, I could have just did that myself.
Exactly. Or what am I doing wrong? Like a lot of people, that creates a lot of, and I know we talked about shame a little bit,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? But like the shame and guilt of, okay, well, I thought I brought it to God, right? Like I did pray about it.
Yeah.
So then now what else am I supposed to do? Or am I not praying hard enough? Or am I not doing enough?
Or what is it that like, I'm seeing all these other people that have given their testimony. Oh, they gave it to God and look what happened. And then I'm going through this and it's like, well, I'm still going through
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So know? Why?
And
yeah.
I think for me with church, it's challenging because religious leaders have a lot of power and influence. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that it's always checked or people don't see them as a human person. So like you said, as a regular human person, they have their own challenges and struggles as well. But as when they have that role of being a religious leader, sometimes some churches or, you know, religious beliefs, they're not as vulnerable with their congregation about their authentic experience. Because, you know, sometimes it's, you know, what's appropriate to say versus what really happened. That's not always the same thing. So I think, like you said, knowing the how, because they'll give you like, this is the story, this is the lesson. But if you're like, if I'm going through it, how do I get there? And that's how therapy can kind of supplement that, because I don't think it's one or the other. I think you can do it both. You can leave something to God and you can also make action, because you can't just say, God fixed all my problems. That's not fair. Like, yeah. he got all these people calling him. You know, that's not fair. So you have to figure out, okay, guide me to where I need to go. What do I need to do on my end?
Yeah.
And oftentimes, once you start doing the work, things will come together for you.
They do.
But you need that guidance, because we learn a lot from failure more than success. Because sometimes you do something well, and by accident, you're like, oh, I'm done with it. But when you fail, you're like, oh, I actually learned how I failed, why that happened, how to avoid the situation again, and tools to navigate if this comes up again.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say that failure is the greatest teacher. So that's very true. So before we wrap up, even though I really do not want to wrap this conversation up, healing tools. You know, we've been talking about all this, but, you know, what if you were sitting amongst more than just me as a Black man,
mm-hmm.
what advice would you give them in the first step to healing and seeking therapy?
I would say you have to see yourself, because sometimes, and we all do it, mm-hmm. you only want to look at the good parts, so you only show the good parts. Really sit with yourself. We try to hide the things that we're not really good at or we're insecure about, and sometimes it doesn't come up until you're in a relationship with someone else, or you're parenting, or, you know, you get to a spot where someone else sees you, they get to know you enough where they see you authentically. So try to sit with yourself and identify, what are my strengths, what am I good at, where are some areas for growth? And then from there you can say, how can I work on that? How can I bolster my confidence in the areas that I'm good at? And how can I strengthen the parts where I need to grow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two things I would just acknowledge. So a lot of times with my clients, when they first come in, I'll ask them, like, if I had a magic wand and I could just, you know, move it around and your life would look different tomorrow, what would that look like? Right? Oh, I'd have more money, or I wouldn't have this issue with my girlfriend, or whatever the case may be. And then we identify what is the major roadblock that's standing in the way of that, right? And sometimes it's basic things, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's I live in a different area. But how do we get to that point? And sometimes even just being able to sit with that is so important. But I also, kind of going back to that original question and going back to even what we were talking about with religion, I think what we have to do is we have to start acknowledging that we are allowed to have a preference. We are allowed to have a preference, and we are allowed to choose. Like, we're allowed to be choosy. And I know that sounds like kind of an odd answer to your question, but I say this oftentimes as it relates to church, but I also think this as it relates to therapists too. As people, oftentimes we are doing something because someone else that came before us did it that way, right? Because that's how we learn, right? I'm going to this church because my mom went to that church, my dad went to this church, or this is the church that I know, or I don't really know of other places. I tried this one therapist, they didn't work out, so I'm not going back to therapy again. Because we have a negative experience, and as a result of the trauma and the intergenerational trauma, right, our brain creates a thought, which is, this is the experience I had, which means that everybody that's in this role is going to be this way. Every pastor is this way. Every therapist is this way. Every doctor is this way. Every job is going to treat me like this. And so as a result, we don't give ourselves the gift of being choosy to be able to say, this therapist sucked, or this therapist spoke to me in a way that was racially antagonizing and not appropriate and not culturally sensitive. I'm going to choose to try someone else because someone else is going to work for me. Every person, every clinician is not for every person. I say that all the time.
It's a vibe test. That's what I say.
It's such a vibe test. It really mm-hmm. is. Does this person mesh with me? Do they see me? I truly believe that Black men deserve to be seen and oftentimes are not seen in our community, right? They're over-sexualized, they're over-stigmatized. Like, who sees you? Who looks at you when you look at them and you feel like they get me? And sometimes it's going to be a vibe. Sometimes it's just going to be the energy in the room. Sometimes it's going to be they said something and it stuck with me and whatever the case may be. And that's going to be across your church. That's going to be in your workplace. Who's the person that I sat with at lunch and we didn't really have much to talk about, but I felt like for the first time I could just eat and chew with my mouth open and I didn't realize I was popping off in the lunchroom, right? Like, who sees me? Yeah. And we have the right to be choosy. We have the right to make preferences. We have the gift of being able to do that. And it's a gift to ourselves, our future children, our future generations, our past ancestors, when we give ourselves that option of seeing who's going to sit with us and who's going to make us feel most comfortable and who's going to make us feel at home. We deserve that everywhere.
And you're the customer. That's how I tell people. Listen, this is your therapy session.
Yeah.
If I'm not a good fit for you, that's okay. I'm not offended. I want you to get someone who aligns with what you're looking for. So just because I'm good in one topic or one area, we may be talking and I'm like, oh, you have a different issue that I'm not an expert in. I'm going to refer you out. And that's okay. We can always circle back when it's something that's within my wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. Because like you said, you're the customer. If you go to a grocery store or you order some food and they get your order wrong, you're not going to stop eating from that restaurant.
Right.
You might just be like, okay, that waitress sucked, but I'll still go back because I like the food. Or I'll go to, you know, a different table, yeah. Which is fine. That's okay.
It is. And sometimes we've had to accept so much. You know, like so many of us have had to deal with the backs. We've dealt with like the burdens on our backs so often that we don't feel safe to be able to say, because I've seen people, right? Like they go to a grocery store, they get something they don't like. Oh, I'll just take it. I'll just deal with it.
Or like, man, yeah. Like they're like, I need a sassy woman that's going to tell the waitress my order is wrong. You need to tell the lady.
Yes. Tell them. You are allowed to assert
yourself.
You're paying
for this. Yeah.
It's your meal, sir. It should be the way that you want it to be.
Well, I thank both of you for being on. If anybody wanted to get in contact with you, what is the best way possible to get in contact with you?
I would say for me, I'm Deja. You can follow me on LinkedIn, Deja Middlebrook, or you can, for our Walking Through Solutions, we have a Facebook, Instagram, Walking Through Solutions. And that's how you can know when I have events coming up, where I'll be. If I have any more interviews, I share all those things. So yeah, follow me, connect. If you have questions, like Chaney said, if you have any ideas, thoughts, let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'm Chaney Brockington. I am a licensed therapist and social worker. And you can find me on LinkedIn as well. LinkedIn's like my primary area for speaking engagements, for continuing conversations. But also, I just recently started a new platform. It's called His, Her, Their Story. And it is essentially a legacy and obituary writing service. We're also doing some work surrounding grief and loss and discussing ambiguous grief. So not just the people that unfortunately we lose through death, but also the people that we lose through relationships ending or through divorce or through life transitions. And so really trying to create that space so you can find that on Instagram. It is His, Her, Their Story, or HHTS Story online. And yeah, you can follow me there.
And can I plug an event that's coming up that's really relevant to this conversation? Yeah. It's not my event. so don't feel pressure. There is an event coming up by That Brown Bag. It is called I Love You Black Man. They do a summit. This is the third one, I think. They do it annually, and it is June 28th, and it's in Buffalo. And it talks about mind, body, spirit. They have different male panelists, and I think they have some women speakers as well, but it's always great from what I hear.
Thank you both for being here. This has been a great conversation. We will circle back to this, I can assure you.
I'll be here. Will. It's got to be done. Thank you so much.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.